Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy. And your plants do too.
Aw,
I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Big news, everyone. You can now listen to Pod Save America ad-free by subscribing to Friends of the Pod. When you join Friends of the Pod, add the Pod Save America subscriber feed to your podcast app of choice. You'll be provided instructions after you subscribe. And that's it. Your fast-forwarding days are over. To subscribe and start listening to Pod Save America without ads right now, head to crooked.com/friends.
It's not one piece of content that we look at and say, oh, that really convinced a bunch of people of something that wasn't true. It's that it contributes to a general feeling that nothing can be trusted and that it's all kind of bullshit and that like all of politics is just whatever lie you can get away with and that it's not really about discussing real issues, but is instead just like, you know, how do you sling mode most effectively? And therefore, I'm just not interested. And it causes that cohort that you're not tuned in to grow because they just view this as some kind of dirty game.
I'm Jon Favreau. Welcome to Offline. Hey, everyone. My guest this week is Jason Goldman, former chief digital officer in the Obama White House, who was at Twitter and Google before that. The 2024 campaign is here, and with it has come a technological breakthrough that everyone seems to be obsessing over: artificial intelligence. Axios has already dubbed 2024 the AI election. Following President Biden's re-election announcement, the RNC ran an ad of an apocalyptic future made entirely of AI images. Ron DeSantis is running ads showing AI images of Donald Trump kissing Dr. Fauci. And that's just the stuff we know about, with over a year left until Election Day. Concerning? Yes. Convincing? To be determined. The truth is, deepfake images and audio are only a small fraction of what AI could mean for politics. It also offers new ways for campaigns to contact voters, message test, and fundraise. Expensive, labor-intensive pursuits that make up the backbone of every campaign. So, AI may pose some benefits for campaigns and voters, but it could also supercharge the misinformation tsunami we've been drowning in for several years now. Jason is the perfect guy to help us sort through all the ways that AI might shape campaigns and politics, not in some distant future, but right now. He's got a well-deserved reputation as one of the smartest people in the space where politics and technology meet. In 2015, after stints at Twitter and Google, Jason became the first ever White House Chief Digital Officer, a role created to help guide a post-healthcare.gov Obama administration into the digital-first era. Since then, he's served as a guide for countless others as they navigate our ever-changing technology ecosystem. We talked about our fears for AI in politics, ways we wish we could have used AI during our stints in the White House, and the digital strategies beyond AI that we think the Biden campaign should explore to ensure victory in 2024. Of course, I also had to get his thoughts on what Elon has done to the app that Jason helped build, what he thinks about Threads, and the unfortunate interest that so many tech bros have taken in politics lately. As always, if you have comments, questions, or episode ideas, please email us at offline@crooked.com. And stick around after the interview. Max and I talk about Sarah Silverman's AI lawsuit and watch some very strange TikTok lives. Here's Jason Goldman. Jason Goldman, welcome to Offline.
Thanks so much for having me.
We got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, it's been a busy couple of weeks.
You and I didn't overlap in the Obama White House, but we've known each other for a while. You have a well-deserved reputation as one of the smartest people out there on how the tech world shapes the political world. So I was hoping you could help us sort through all the fuss around artificial intelligence as it relates to politics, campaigns, regulations, all that good stuff. Axios had a very Axios headline the other day that read, "The 2024 presidential race is the AI election." Do you think that's right?
Yeah, it's going to be the AI election because, like, instead of like NASCAR moms, it's going to be large language model moms or something. That'll be the key constituency.
It's going to be bots, chatbots. Yeah.
You have to have your constituency outreach for bots.
How much of an impact do you think it will have on 2024?
I do actually think it will have a significant impact. I think that there will both be a number of legitimate, significant uses of AI, particularly generative AI and large language models by the campaigns. I think there'll be some breakthrough moments in which you see some surprising or concerning events as it relates to deepfakes. We've already had some kind of signal on that. And I think there'll be a bunch of stuff kind of bubbling under the surface that we will have to unpack in time.
Can you talk about the different ways campaigns are already using AI right now?
Yeah. So I think the ones that have gotten the most attention thus far are the generative AI as it relates to images and voice, because you can do deepfakes as, you know, pretending to be the candidate or create a rapid response ad as the RNC did when Biden did his announcement and showed, you know, San Francisco being barricaded and all of this stuff. And so that's going to get a lot of attention right out the gate. You know, DeSantis ran this ad of Trump kissing Fauci, which I think only annoyed MAGA voters. And, you know, you're going to see a lot of examples of those types of things, of fake generative content from the campaigns. And that's what we've seen so far.
Let's talk about some of the positive use cases.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like using AI to make fundraising, voter contact more efficient are examples of good use cases. Are there others? And are there dangers I'm missing even within those good use case examples of voter contact and fundraising?
There are definitely good use cases. And I think that's one of the things that should be highlighted, is that these tools actually can be a boon for campaigns. And even putting aside the deepfake things, which need to be looked at, campaigns are very expensive. They, you know, require, particularly presidentials, take a tremendous amount of people to run. And you can streamline these, particularly with respect to generative AI being used to create fundraising emails, generative AI being used to train volunteers. There's a lot of ways in which these technologies could make the campaigns more efficient. And I think that could be virtuous if done responsibly. I think there's, you know, there's a whole aspect of AI as well that's about using the data that campaigns have to create better messaging and to enable better testing in terms of how the campaign engages with the world. And, you know, look, there's a lot of parts of campaigning that are just frankly broken. I mean, you guys have talked about a lot polling and the problems with polling. It's not as though that couldn't be improved with better technology if we had a better sense. So there's a lot that could be done here.
On the, like, using AI to make messaging, fundraising appeals more effective, I think probably most people listening, their experience with AI is like a ChatGPT, if there's
right.
any experience at all. You know, I have been playing around with that. And, you know, I was like, write a speech in the style of Barack Obama, you
right.
know? And it's like, fine.
Right.
It's not super creative. How would AI go about helping sort of improve a fundraising pitch, a fundraising email, a message or something like that?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point because I think a lot of folks think of these tools like ChatGPT, which is incredibly powerful and interesting. ChatGPT's own terms of use prohibits the use for campaigns. So it's not actually the most relevant tool in the political context and political campaign context. What is interesting is the idea of creating a trained AI model that is trained on the data that campaigns have on likely voters, on what works for their messaging. You can imagine campaigns that have a large number of data points in terms of what they think is persuasive, what has moved people in the past to actually show up, what has moved people in the past to donate, and feeding that into a custom created large language model that's based on an open sourced large language model base, and using that to do things like message testing to say, does this make someone more likely to show up for us on election day? Is this going to make them more likely to donate for us? And so I think that's like a really specific campaign idea that is going to get developed and made into businesses in this cycle.
Well, and it also sounds like if you know, you're talking about the problems with polling, but usually what happens in a campaign is people do a bunch of focus groups, they do a bunch of polling, and they say, okay, this demographic group
right.
tends to respond well to this policy idea, this value message, whatever else, and then They'll tell that to us speechwriters and we'll try to write something for the candidate. Are you saying that AI could potentially sort of replace the consultant part of it?
So this is the part that I think, this is the part that I think is interesting. You know, I haven't worked on campaigns, but I did work in the White House in communications. And one of the challenges you always have in that is like, what's the ROI on this? Like we had this tweet and it had this engagement, but what did people take away from that? You know, what did we win? And I think what you could do is if you had a robust model that you could feed this content into that allowed you to say for a given phrase or for a given or for a given policy definition, how does this move a likely voter? You'd have a much more specific way of answering that that wasn't reliant on survey paneling and that wasn't reliant on doing focus groups, both of which take time to do after the fact. You could just run this into the model before you push it out the door. And I think to me, that's really interesting because it kind of gets to one of the core uncertainties in politics, which is it, you know, people have strong opinions about this is the way you talk about this to these voters. And it's all based on some kind of science, but this would be another tool that you could use to augment that understanding of the electorate.
One of the things I'm wondering about now that I hear this is, I mean, maybe the biggest problem with polling today is you have people who are low social trust voters, don't participate in polls and don't participate in focus groups, and then show up and surprise us with who they vote for. And because AI is so dependent on what information and data you put into it, I wonder how you sort of capture these low information, low engagement, low social trust voters into a data set that would then sort of dictate a campaign's message and strategy via AI.
Yeah, I think the voter file ends up becoming like a bigger, ends up becoming like a bigger source of data, and as well as past survey data, because you'd get people that responded to things online, and you would have some sense of what they actually had said they'd done, and that would become a more meaningful input. Now, I mean, look, I don't want to get too far down the this is a miraculous technology that will solve all problems, and we should talk about the ways it should be used responsibly. But I do think there's a part of this conversation with respect to AI and large language models where the tools are very interesting and there are things that can be done with them that are new and potentially useful. And we should find the right ways to harness those things.
And to the point you made, you know, I've heard a bunch of people saying that this could sort of democratize the process of running a campaign.
Right.
So do you think we'll get to a point where these tools will be made available even to like a local campaign, a congressional campaign?
Right. I do think that's one of the interesting things because it, you know, look, copywriting is a very intensive task. I mean, you may know that writing content in the voice of a principal is both a challenging and time consuming task. Mm. And if we can make that more accessible in a way that was still authentic to the campaign, to me, that seems like a continuation of what campaigns already do. Not everything a candidate says and not every statement that's put out by a candidate is actually written or, you know, by the candidate, like, you know, spoilers for people who had that fantasy.
Otherwise, I would not be here.
Right. So it's like, you know, so instead we're just going to have another tool that helps with that. And I think that can be virtuous in the hands of people who use it ethically.
Yeah. Look, from a speechwriting perspective, I am currently not worried that AI is going to take speechwriters' jobs.
Right.
But the way that I would use it if I was speechwriting right now is like, spit out a first draft that has the right message, the right policy, whatever else, and then I can then edit it and put it in the voice of the candidate. That would save me a bunch of time and energy.
That's right.
All right, let's talk about some of the more nefarious uses for campaigns. You mentioned the deep fakes, videos, voices. You know, the RNC ad that you referenced.
Weren't fooled. You didn't think that San Francisco had gotten taken over.
Yeah, well, it's not even like I wasn't fooled. I was sort of like, what's the point of this other than getting attention for creating an ad using only AI, which I think that was the point.
Right.
Because that didn't seem like it was. And I also thought that the Trump kissing Fauci thing seemed sort of silly. What do you think the dangers are when it comes to more sophisticated uses of AI and campaigns?
So staying on the deepfakes one, for example, ones that are a little more complicated. There was a Turkish candidate for president who dropped out after there was an alleged sex tape leaked about him that he claims was a deepfake. And that's like an interesting case. And I think in general, Turkey is actually, you know, a relatively sophisticated information environment, but there's plenty of places in which there isn't as robust a national press, or there isn't as robust an information environment, and you could get something out there that demonstrably changed the way in which a candidate or an issue was viewed in a given market, and that could be a problem. And, you know, in this case, this guy claims that it was a sex tape. I don't know, but like, if it was that, you know, this forced a candidate out of a campaign.
Well, the example that I keep hearing is people saying that if the Access Hollywood tape dropped right now, Trump would say it was a deep fake.
Yeah, and I think that is the bigger threat, which is that it's not one piece of content that we look at and say, oh, that really convinced a bunch of people of something that wasn't true. It's that it contributes to a general feeling that nothing can be trusted and that it's all kind of bullshit, and that like all politics is just whatever lie you can get away with, and that it's not really about discussing real issues, but is instead just like, you know, how do you sling mode most effectively, and therefore I'm just not interested. And it causes that cohort that you talked about previously, you're not tuned in, to grow because they just view this as some kind of dirty game.
Yeah, I mean, look, we don't have a shortage of people who've been fooled by some fairly low-tech disinformation.
Right.
So there's part of me when I hear about the AI stuff, I'm like, well, I don't know that we need more sophisticated disinformation to fool people, because we're not doing so well right now.
Right.
But it does seem like this would just push on an open door and sort of deepen the distrust people have towards the institution of politics, media, et cetera.
I think that's right. And I think the big thing that in addition to that happening, I think what's also going to be the biggest harm in this cycle is not going to be the deepfake Daisy ad. Like, it's not going to be the one thing that we all see, you know, the Pope puffer jacket political ad that we all see got briefly fooled by and becomes a big story. It's going to be something that works for some small number of people, but in a key area. I mean, presidential campaigns are decided by relatively few number of people in very well-known places. And so all you need to do is try to figure out something that kind of continually pushes that group using some kind of synthetic media. And that's like a net positive. And it's very cheap to do that. And you can do that in a non-overt way. You can just find the right, you know, WhatsApp group. You can find the right, Facebook group. And you can just kind of sort of create a trickle of content before it's even detected as being fake. You know, there was this fake Twitter account, Erica Marsh.
Oh yeah,
that was this like fake leftist that was, you know, the Washington Post kind of exposed. She just announced today that she's taking a break.
I thought her account was suspended.
She got it back and now she's taking a break. She needs a hiatus from all of this attention. But that was like a very public account, right? I mean, that was, you know, the Washington Post reporter. Everybody saw it. It became a whole thing. Imagine someone like that who's just like, you know, Aunt Sally's friend or whatever, who gets invited to the group. To me, that seems very possible and tractable.
Yeah, and I think that is dangerous for a few reasons. One, like you said, if it's going to a specific group, it can be under the radar, harder to detect from the media. Also, the media is not like, you know, we can talk in a second about sort of like the struggles that local media is having. You go to some community and there's a robocall.
Right.
And the robocall is from Joe Biden. And, you know, we've done plenty of AI Joe Biden.
They're very good.
On this show. Thanks to Tommy Vitor. Those are sort of, you obviously know it's a joke because Joe Biden would never say shit like that. But I feel like so far the AI we've seen has almost been too exaggerated, or the fake stuff has been too exaggerated, like the Trump kissing Fauci, the San Francisco ad and stuff like that. It really just could be subtle.
Exactly.
And it could be something that would be believable for Joe Biden to say, but he says it and it's damaging in a certain community and then no one knows about it until it's too late.
Yeah. Hank Green had this really interesting take on the Pope and a puffer AI thing, mm-hmm. which is like the reason that worked. He's like, you know, all these people are saying you could just zoom in and see that he's got like six fingers. Like, why? You're so stupid. You just need to look at the images. Like, that's not the point. The point is that the reason that worked is because it didn't run afoul of any of our previous conceptions of the Pope. We don't think about the Pope that much. And if we did, we'd be like, yeah, maybe he's got a funny jacket on. Like, it was believable enough.
Yeah.
It conformed to our existing biases of what we thought was possible for the Pope. And so similarly, something that's mainly in line with what something Joe Biden might say, and particularly for an audience who might be conditioned to believe that, that's going to work. And it could just travel as a voice memo in a WhatsApp chain for weeks before anyone knows that it happened.
Well, so this is sort of my larger question, like AI or no AI, I feel like we've all been fighting a mostly losing battle against the spread of disinformation over the last couple of years. We got right-wing propaganda outlets. Social media platforms are a mess. We now have Republicans in Congress suing and investigating disinformation researchers. Like, what's your latest thinking on how campaigns, governments can deliver trusted sources of information that voters will actually believe?
Yeah. So I think it's important to start with the context that you laid out, which is that we've actually backslid from, you know, where we are now compared to where we are in, you know, 2020. I think January 6th and I think the pandemic both forced social media companies writ large to kind of take more seriously their obligations to not, you know, play a role in fomenting a rebellion and also to not spread information that would potentially kill people. And I think that the other side has done such a good job working the refs on that, particularly with some of the investigations where you talk about where they're so committed to free speech that they're going to haul in academics to Congress to force them to testify about their work. You know, I think they've done such a good job politicizing any of those ideas, whether it's, you know, election denialism, anti-vax, or even the notion that you should be able, whether you should be able to include deepfakes in a political ad. You know, the FEC deadlocked on the question of whether or not deepfakes should be possible in a deep in a political ad. And, you know, there's a bill in Congress that Klobuchar introduced to disallow deepfakes in political ads, which seems straightforward, will certainly not become law. And so, you know, I think we've backslid because they've done such a good job working the refs. That still does mean that there's a big obligation on political campaigns from progressives and progressive activists to continue to push this argument and say that platforms have a responsibility and to try to get them back to some of the positions they had previously.
Well, so there's pressure on the platforms, public pressure on the platforms. There's, you know, government regulation, which we can get to in a second. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, reporters sort of trying to call people on their bullshit more. I'll yell at them some more too. But if you're in a campaign,
right,
and you're in the White House, you're in the Biden administration, and you are trying to fight disinformation, like, what are some of the best ways to actually communicate with the groups that you're trying to communicate with in a way that sort of builds trust?
Yeah.
Like, is this more in-person campaigning? Is this more like spreading messages to your social networks of people who trust you? Like,
yeah. So I have a theory about this that I think is something that the Biden administration has actually done really well in their digital strategy. And it's what I would call generally, like, you know, third party channels. Like, you know, in a traditional political communications shop, you've got you've got the folks who talk to the press corps, and you've got, you know, specialty media, and digital kind of became this new creature. And during the time that I was in the White House, we got a lot of benefit from operating the White House digital channels because they were novel, whether that's, you know, Twitter or Instagram. Anytime we launched something, we got a lot of earned media from just doing that. But now, you know, 8 years later, that's old business. Everyone has one of those. You don't get a lot of attention from joining Threads, right? You know, that's expected. But what you can do is go to third-party channels, people who have an audience that you want to reach, and find a way to engage with them on topics and that you care about. So it's what's been called the White House's influencer strategy, where they've done a good job of, like, you know, bringing TikTok folks in to hear national security briefings. I think this is a really key part of a modern campaign infrastructure. The issue is that it's actually fairly expensive to run, because you have to, in terms of time, you have to go find these people, you have to cultivate them, figure out what issues they care about, bring them in, find the right way to engage them. But I think this is the way to both effectively campaign and reach people who you otherwise wouldn't be able to talk to, and also inoculates you from a lot of disinformation, because you have a trusted person who, for a given audience, is trusted on a topic. Maybe it's sports, maybe it's a murder podcast, whatever it is, but they're trusted for that audience. And if you can find a way to engage with them, you then have a degree of trust that you're not going to earn by having your op-ed in the New York Times or giving a statement from the podium, even. Like, it's just not even, you're just not going to reach or be trusted in the same way by doing that.
That's interesting. So, you know, if there's a bunch of people listening to RFK Jr. on Joe Rogan spout a bunch of crazy conspiracies,
right,
instead of maybe just going on Joe Rogan yourself, if you're the candidate, to do another round with him or RFK Jr., maybe you find out, like, who else is listening to Joe Rogan that might be listening to another podcast or another piece of media that maybe the candidate could go on and reach those people that way.
Yeah, this connects to the AI conversation because the world that we exist in right now is this increasingly fractured online media environment with the collapse of Twitter as like a central, you know, news media hub and the rise of all these other places. People are going to find their own niches, multiple places in which they hang out. And some of those are going to be the Discord for a podcast. Some of those are going to be, you know, a WhatsApp group that they, you know, is with, you know, all of their high school buddies. You know, there's going to be different places that are the most trusted media source for those folks. And campaigns are going to have to figure out that it's just not sufficient to just put the tweet out and earn the headline that you hoped you got, which worked 8 years ago. That same factor is not going to work. And the way that AI plays into it is that you should be able to operationalize some of this a bit easier if you have some more assistive technology that can, you know, help you write the right message for the right place, identify what those places are. You know, there is some things there that we could hope the technology could help with.
And particularly, I'd imagine it'd be helpful in finding audiences, segmenting audiences, and figuring out where those audiences are getting their information from.
Which is the biggest challenge. I mean, we had this idea when I was in the White House, and it was very labor intensive to find those folks. And it also, you know, classically just pisses off the traditional, you know, political press. The famous Obama doing an interview with Glozell thing remains, like, you still see it mentioned, like, even though it was, you know, 9 years ago or whatever. Yeah. It's a real sore point. and so that does require a lot of effort, though, to find those folks. You can imagine the technology being helpful.
Just on the topic of media and reporters and journalism, what do you think AI does to journalism, which is an industry that's already struggling, especially, you know, it's the decimation of local media,
right?
You know, cable news ratings dropping, as you said, you know, Twitter is sort of falling apart. Like, what if media outlets start using AI to sort of replace writing and even reporting, like, what does that look like?
I mean, probably not great to start, right? Yeah. it's not great. I think particularly, and this goes back to your conversation about campaigns on a local level, I think this is a real concern because with the decimation of local media and trusted sources that are impartial, how are you going to know in a school board election that some claim is completely fabricated if you're not in a major city with a robust media environment? And like, AI is not going to solve that. There's going
to
be...
In fact, it may contribute to the problem.
Exactly. Like, you know, you're going to need to actually... We need to rebuild some of this infrastructure. And, you know, whether that's through, you know, there's a lot of people who are trying to approach this through new models for local journalism, whether that's through, you know, philanthropic aided models or whether that's through new, you know, new bottoms up based models of restarting local journalism places like Chicago. Like, there's ideas for how to do this, but we really need to turbocharge that. I mean, there's no kind of substituting a fundamental pillar of the democratic process with the bots.
So on Pod Save America a few weeks ago, Dan Pfeiffer asked White House Chief of Staff Jeff Zients about AI and regulation. And Jeff actually said, he was like, it's one of the top three issues that we care about in the White House that we're working on. And he said that we're like right in the middle of figuring out what we can do on the regulation side. What do you think they should be looking at?
Well, look, let's, first of all, I think I've been favorably impressed from the outside just how the White House has thought about this issue. Like, you know, they did the convening with the CEOs, like, you know, I live in San Francisco and President Biden was out there meeting with, you know, some of the top researchers in the world, like hearing from this, vice president's hearing from civil rights leaders. So they're really doing a robust effort. The other thing I'll say is there's tremendous in-house talent, as you know, at the White House. You get like the best people in the world to work on these questions. That's true in technology as well. Like, the Office of Science and Technology Policy previously was headed by Alondra Nelson, and she wrote the blueprint on an AI Bill of Rights, which is a really interesting document. And then OSTP is now headed by Aarthi Prabhakar, who also is an expert in this field, and they're doing really interesting work on risk mitigation. So they have tremendous talent and are focused on this problem in an interesting way. In terms of what should be done, I like to take a step back on like how we think about regulation with respect to tech. I was in this, you know, I was one of the nerds that Obama brought in to the White House from Silicon Valley. There's a bunch of us who came in the wake of, I don't know if you know this, but there's this website called healthcare.gov. It didn't work well. And he brought in a bunch of people who had worked on websites to, you know, kind of restart how the government approaches technology. And we were in this meeting once with Dennis McDonough's chief of staff, and Dennis and everyone was sort of, we were talking about technology policy, and everyone was sort of voicing the kind of standard Silicon Valley spiel on regulation, which is like, look, we've been able to grow into this dominant, you know, quadrant of the American economy because we've been relatively lightly regulated, you know, and that's what's led to innovation, that's led the world and produced all this miraculous stuff. And Dennis McDonough paused and said, that's great. We're the federal government. We regulate everyone. Like, you don't get to come in here and say, we're an oil company, we've powered the world's cars and boats, and there's just no oversight needed. Yeah. And to me, I think about this moment all the time, because if you just view this industry as analogous to the other types of technological change that have happened in America over time, we have continued to be a great innovator, not despite of, but because we've had a good regulatory regime that's made technology safer, has inspired trust in those technologies, and has allowed civil society writ large to have input on how that technology should evolve. So that should just be true for anything else, up to and including AI.
I'll tell you why I don't think that happened with tech is because, you know, and Dennis said, we're the federal government, we regulate everything. If it's a Democratic administration, so you have one party that doesn't want to regulate anything anyway. Democrats do want to regulate most things, but tech had a brand, of course, as you know, early on, that was innovation, progress, inclusion, connection, and it just seemed very like, oh, this is in line with liberal values, right?
That's right.
And so they sort of got away with a bunch of shit until we all realized that social media was making us all crazy.
we all make mistakes.
You know, I was there. I was like, yeah, it's great. I went with him to the Facebook trip. Yeah. I was there.
Yeah.
But so I think that's been part of the problem with Democratic administrations or Washington in general regulating tech. And tech is obviously technology companies have taken advantage of that. And clearly Washington missed the opportunity to do anything about social media.
Right.
What lessons do you think AI will be any different, number one? And do you think like DC has learned any lessons from its past failures in this area?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the other reason why tech, particularly social media, was different as well is because there's real actual First Amendment questions that are not true for a car and are not true for airplanes. So like there is a substantive distinction there as well.
Yeah.
However, I think that is not as true for some of the things that we're talking about here. And I do think that there was a lesson learned that we're just not going to let this play out in the same way. For what it's worth, I think the technology companies believe that as well at this point. I don't think the tech industry exists in that world and has that same viewpoint that I was talking about that we were saying in 2015. I think the industry now welcomes active engagement with government and civil society because they want to know where the lines are, and they know that they need to engage because there was so much bad blood built up during the social media era, and that frankly, the technology evolves better when there are clear lines. You know, with respect to AI, it's the same thing. Like, I think there are real risks, both the types of things that we're talking about and more serious risks of, you know, cybersecurity and bio threats that need to be looked at and are the appropriate venue for government to think about. But the same kind of calculus applies as with any other area of regulation, which is that if you can draw lines where you say above this threshold, we need to apply some increased level of scrutiny, and here's how standards are set, and here's how input is solicited and incorporated into that process, then you create a wide area for innovation to happen and for there to be, you know, some of the exciting things that we talked about already that can happen.
So I don't want to ask you to go into the weeds or give me the entire summary of the AI Bill of Rights, but what do you think are like top principles for regulation of this very powerful new technology?
I mean, look, some of this stuff should just be caught, right? Like the Klobuchar bill of just there shouldn't be deepfakes and ads. The fact that it's not going to become law because of weird Congress stuff, that notwithstanding, like that is the kind of thing that can happen. For me, it's some of these are less about the specific things that are in and out, and more, what are the layers at which these questions get asked and tackled? Like who, you know, what are the norms that industry is developing for itself to govern AI safety and AI ethics? You know, what are the ways in which activists and advocacy groups get input into the process to make sure that questions of bias and discrimination are argued for. There's really hard questions like, you know, job displacement, where we're not going to know what happens until the technology is out there for longer. But, you know, that's something where there's going to need to be a government society response too. It's going to have to say, like, what are the right ways to ensure against job loss? Like, how do we strengthen unions? All of those questions are the appropriate domain. And some of those things are being worked on. I mean, the Screenwriters Guild strike is not wholly about this, but it is one of the issues, is to figure out how unions maintain a seat at the table in the face of advancing generative AI. And I think that's the appropriate course for some of these questions to get worked out.
So, you know, it doesn't seem like we'll get a bunch of regulations between now and, well, the campaign's already started.
Yeah.
So we're going to go through this campaign probably in a regulation-free environment around AI. We talked a little bit about how campaigns can navigate around this. Like, what should voters be looking for?
So I do go back to that comment about, you know, if something conforms too closely to your kind of pre-existing biases of what should happen, it should raise a flag to you. If like you see something, you're like, oh, that is so true. And you're like, how true is that? But it's a good opportunity to ask, how true is that?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's also places where, you know, I think also if you're someone who's a progressive and you're looking to help out and during the course of campaigns, I think you should ask yourself too, like, to whom are the audiences that you are a trusted voice? Like, who is like someone that you can help, like, sort of say, actually, that was not real, and here's the real thing on that. Like, some of that is just being a good active citizen and being willing to participate with your, you know, friends and neighbors. But some of it is also just realizing that we all exist in different media environments in which we are either, you know, audience or trusted source. And how do the issues that you care about like end up playing in that context?
So I know, you know, from your White House days, you've thought a lot about ways to reach voters in a very fractured media environment. You sort of talked about the Biden administration's influencer strategy. Are there other strategies you think campaigns should be thinking about as we head into, even aside from AI, as we head into 24?
Yeah, and I tend to end up seeing a lot of problems as organizational and structural problems with regards to entities, as opposed to being like tactics based, and that the organization ends up informing the strategy. And by that I mean, with the Obama White House, like the context that allowed me to come into the job of chief digital officer was that there was a new media team, like a digital team, but they were like literally in the basement of the EEOB and like no one had talked to them for a while, right? Like, you know, and they were like, you know, sort of had a bunch of mini fridges that were full of questionable chow mein or whatever. And so like, you know, and it really was that there was just no one at the senior staff level that was advocating for, actually, this doesn't need to be a speech. We could just do this as whatever. And, you know, Pfeiffer was really—
I would have loved that.
Yeah.
could use that when I was there.
Well, you know, Pfeiffer really led a lot of this, like before his, you know, before he helped bring me into this job, like, you know, the releasing the State of the Union on Medium and the, you know, Two Ferns thing. And like, you know, this was the start of that. But it took someone at Pfeiffer's level to, you know, be able to advocate for that. That's it. Those same issues exist on campaigns. Too often, and in other organizations, too often it's the case that like the digital team is seen as like sort of the internet magic tricks department that's like supposed to make it like cool or like, you know, do something that works for kids or whatever. And that's—
which is wild that that's still how they're seen. Like that was the case in 2008 on the Obama campaign. I can't believe this many years later, it's still— it's gotten better, I bet.
I think it's gotten better. There's always a new generation of kids that no one understands is like part
that
of the
is
issue.
True. Yeah, that is true.
And so there's that challenge as well. But the way in which this gets solved is by having, you know, digital be an equal part of the tripod to, you know, how you engage with the political press corps, how you engage with earned media generally, you know, magazine articles, you know, TV pieces, whatever. Digital should be a third part of the tripod on that. You know, I just want to shout out my successor, Rob Flaherty, who just left the White House. And this is a very wonky point, but listeners might appreciate it. Like, Rob in his time there managed to like upgrade the Office of Digital Strategy to be an assistant to the president office, which was the highest like staff level, which wasn't true before, and got a West Wing office, like, you know, for that off. You know, these things sound like ceremonial, but as you know, this actually matters in terms of, are you in the conversation when they're putting together the thing about what the president's going to do on Tuesday? And that's true in a campaign as well. And Rob was able to do that. And I think that bodes well for, you know, the Biden campaign's like approach to these questions.
So before the White House, you were VP of product at Twitter.
Yeah.
I know you aren't exactly a fan of what Elon Musk has done with the platform.
It's not going great. I mean, I don't think we can say it's going great.
It's not. I feel like we've all been on like Twitter death watch for a while now.
Yeah.
What do you think happens? What's your sense of how this is?
So look, I'm biased against Twitter dying because I worked there and we actively tried to kill it for like 4 years through incompetence and infighting. And so like, you know, we were unable to bring the bird down despite the fact that like, you know, we switched CEOs like every 18 months and like the site didn't work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it survived that time. And so I continue to believe that Twitter will not die. It will just become more broken and more stupid. And that I think is kind of the trajectory that it's on. I think during the 2024 cycle, I think it's likely that Twitter ends up still owning particularly a right-leaning aspect of the political conversation that's happening. And I think they, and you know, there's this argument that, well, without any libs to fight against, like, you know, will it still be interesting? But there's enough libs to fight against. Like,
yeah,
it's still happening. Like, we're still fighting today. So I think that part will continue. What I do think is that we're at a very strange moment for social media generally, because, and I think you have to really temper your predictions because we've never quite seen this before, where one dominant platform in 6 months has essentially just, you know, shot itself in all feet available, grew new feet, shot those. You know, the rate limiting and the blocking off of tweets is just truly crazy behavior if you're running that business. And we've seen, you know, dominant new entrants like Threads, as well as a lot of experimental new types of platforms like Blue Sky and the Mastodon interests and Spill. And I think those are going to work. I just think they're all going to work. I think they're all going to find audiences for specific things. And those niches will matter for the people that are on them. And I think that we've not yet seen, either with Blue Sky or with Threads, what happens when this federated play kind of comes out, because both of them are meant to be federated protocols that allow anyone to kind of, you know, interact with them off of the main app. Neither one of them have actually built that yet.
Yeah.
And so maybe that produces a whole, I think that will just continue the trend of people finding their own niches that really work for them with their own rules, that their own content rules that make sense. And I think it makes it a lot harder, going back to the political conversation, of finding the right places to play in, because it may well be that there's some conversation in some federated instance that's really relevant to an audience that you care about, and you're going to have to go find that and figure out a way to play with that.
Well, it's tough if you're a political professional or
right.
in the media.
Yeah.
It's
very
like
tiring.
I found it I found it very annoying to like now go on Twitter, check out Threads, and neither of which is giving me all the news and all the in the way I want it, all the curated news that Twitter used to give me when it was working.
Right.
And but like from a consumer, a media consumer perspective or a voter perspective, like I don't know how you find some space where like all the relevant news is at one time.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that is the new reality, is that you're not going to see everything in one place. You're going to see some slice of things. And I'm sure you've had this experience as well, where like you catch up at some point later in the day and you're like, wait, that's a whole thing? Like some general got assassinated? What, you know, like, or whatever it is, you know, and you know, someone group texts you like, oh, like, what about this crazy thing? You're like, I'm supposed to be the one that knows about, I'm the one who texts the group thread about
I'm
this.
I'm the addict.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and
no.
And it's very, it's this like kind of free fall experience if you're a sicko like us. although I heard you had gotten better. I'm sad that it didn't.
I got a little better now. Well, the Threads coming on, I'm like, now there's two apps that I'm checking.
Now there's two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really complicated. And I think that will be the reality, is that you see different stories pop off in different places, and there's a whole culture that happens around it that's distinct from another one, and you're going to have to choose where you spend the majority of your time. And if you're in media, if you're in politics, if you're one of these places that wants to be in the water cooler conversation, now there's an infinity of water coolers. I think that's just, I don't think anyone's going to win. And I don't think Twitter's going to die. So I think there's just going to be a lot of stuff around that. Although I feel less confident about my Twitter not dying prediction than I did like 6 months ago, because it's gotten so very broken.
What do you think Elon's like biggest, most impactful mistake or mistakes yeah. has been since it, during his tenure.
Definitely the Twitter blue thing, in my view. And it goes back to the disinformation AI question. You know, there was this, someone posted this image of something crashing in the Pentagon, and there was a flash crash on Wall Street because someone, you know, it was assumed it was a terrorist attack. It was like 4 weeks ago or something like that. And the relevant part of that is not the AI. Like the image was not like, you know, required some quantum computer to generate, you know, this amazing facsimile of a terrorist attack. The issue was that the image was distributed by a blue check account on Twitter. And so it seemed credible. And so Elon, out of essentially pique, decided to punish the lib blue checks who had been verified, you know, in order to overthrow the lords and peasants system, and instead allow, you know, the cat turd twos of the world to become the dominant source of news media. And apologies if you know, to people, or if you
a lot of cat turd fans out there,
if you both know what that is or don't know what that is. But yeah, I mean, that ends up becoming this seminal moment, because I think it does two things. One is, he foregrounds all of those weirdos who are like right-wing lunatics. Yeah. And it's this moment of audience capture for him, because he wants to be seen and liked by your cat turd twos and your Andrew Tates and, like, you know, all of these people who are really poisonous to a mainstream advertiser business, which is what he bought. And then two, he punishes the people who are actually producing the content that people wanted to see, you know, your celebrities, music, you know, stars, film stars, media personalities. And he views it as like, I'm lowering the playing field. And if you want to be here, you should pay me $8. And they view it as, I've been giving you free labor for years to make this network valuable. This blue check is more valuable to you and your network than it is to me. If you think I'm going to pay you anything, like, you can go pound sand. And that's, you know, what happened. So I think that inversion both poisoned the network and created a lot of these information integrity problems.
One of the reasons I asked that question is, you mentioned the time that you were at Twitter, and I don't want to make you have to relive every moment.
No, it's fine.
Moment.
It's a long time ago.
But, like, why do you think Twitter couldn't be as successful as maybe you guys wanted it to be even before Elon? Like, what is there a version of Twitter in your mind that could have work that could solve some of the biggest problems without solving all the problems?
Yeah, so I tend to be very fatalistic just in general, and particularly respect to technology. And so my read on what happened with Twitter is that we had a good idea that fortuitously caught this amazing wave in terms of a paradigm shift in society and technology, which was the mobile revolution. Mm-hmm. Twitter comes out shortly before the launch of the iPhone, and all of a sudden, we've got a short-form messaging service which is built for people to check all the time on their phones. And we ride that wave very successfully. However, it just wasn't as successful as Facebook was able to ride that wave. Facebook, it turned out, had a more valuable piece of real estate in this revolution, which was the friend graph. And they were able to build more interesting properties on top of it. Also, Facebook is just a better executor, we should confess. Like Zuckerberg was a much better executor than any of the people who ran Twitter, and had a better way of operating that company.
Do you think the ad business was easier because of the structure of the format of Facebook than Twitter too?
100%. Yeah. Both the structure and the data that they had on the users. Now, I mean, part of this is, it was not just Facebook was really good at executing. They were also very aggressive in terms of how they built that ad business, in terms of what data and signal they mined. And we did not have that, nor did we engage in some of the same tactics. And as a result, when Twitter was moving towards becoming a public company, there were two issues. One was a relentless focus on increasing top of funnel growth, making more users come in the door, and very little focus on preventing churn of people who actually got what the product was. And the second mistake was comparing continually the business of Twitter to Facebook and saying to the street, this is going to be Facebook, but better, which was just never going to be possible from an ads business standpoint. It just didn't have as good a piece of real estate as Facebook had, for a variety of reasons, including the ones you mentioned. And so it kind of doomed Twitter as a public company in some ways, because it was just going to always be continually compared to Facebook. So I think those two decisions, if we could go back and change, maybe would have had some effect. But I think it's probable that we just slightly had a less valuable piece of turf in this revolution that happened, which going back to your question, what's going to happen next, is why now is a very difficult time to predict what's going to happen, because we're on the precipice of another one of those revolutions. Like, you know, we tried to force two other technological paradigm revolutions to happen. Crypto, which turned out was only good for scams, and goggles, which it turns out no one wants to wear.
Right.
AI, it turns out, is actually useful for things, as we've talked about, and many other use cases besides. And you can feel the urgency by which this wants to be the next paradigm evolution. Mm. And that's going to provoke a new type of growth and a new type of social experience as well. We don't know what that's going to look like, but it's in the cards.
Well, last question, I'll just go back to, you know, who's leading this revolution. Like, why do you think so many of these tech and VC characters, mostly dudes, seem to have political opinions that range from obtuse to awful?
Right.
Elon, David Sachs,
yeah,
the All In podcast dudes, all these people running up. Like, you've worked with some of these types of people.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on there?
Yeah, I think, so there's two things. One is, I think a lot is written about the sort of libertarian mindset in tech. And I kind of alluded to that myself around the regulation conversation. I think that is true. Like, there is kind of a, I'm socially liberal, but fiscally conservative, or, you know, like, I don't want this stuff. And, you know, whatever. I don't want any people building any houses near me and stuff like that. Right.
Right.
Is what a lot of this comes down to. Like, you know, Mark Andreessen, who wrote the It's Time to Build post, but, like, you know, also took it on op-ed, like, please don't increase zoning in Menlo or whatever. And so I think there's that aspect of it. I think a more important factor for people to be aware of that is less considered is it is often the case that the right thing to do with technology, particularly the internet, is to invent from first principles, to, like, consider, like, oh, what would it mean to, like, you know, how would a restaurant work if, like, you know, you could just do anything in code? Like, you know, how would transportation work? There's terrible downsides to this, right? Like, I don't want to, like, overhype that as a great way of doing things. There's terrible downside to that. But, like, in terms of building businesses, it is often the right mentality of, like, what if we were unconstrained, by the way, and we just discovered it from first principles. As a result, you see this in both Elon, the All In guys, the tech industry writ large. There's this assumption, you saw it a lot during the pandemic, which is that we can just apply from first principles to any problem. Like, during the pandemic, you could just say, like, all right, I'm just going to start doing my own research on sort of where this virus came from and what can be done. I had a lot of friends who were, like, you know, funding research, like, you know, building kits, like, you know, trying to, you know, sharing evidence, sometimes well-intentioned, and sometimes funding really important projects.
I'll figure out the vaccines. The government doesn't need to do that. I'm just going to just Google it.
Yeah. And as a result, a surprisingly large number of very successful tech people ended up taking the horse paste because, like, you know, it turns out that you can just go, like, anyone can go down the rabbit hole. Like, the rabbit hole does not care if you have, you know, a house in the Hamptons and a private jet. The rabbit hole is there for you too.
Yeah.
and you will find your own way in.
Elon is the best example.
Exactly.
Of this.
The richest man in the world has been completely captured by Cat Turd 2. It's wild. It's absolutely wild.
That is my fundamental take on what happened to Elon, right?
Yeah.
It's like, he can build these cars, he can build these rocket ships, and then he just became too online, he went down a rabbit hole, and his brain got fried just like anyone else.
And the attention he gets back from these people is tremendously meaningful to him, and as a result, he's turned Twitter into a product that amplifies all of that. It's become the subreddit for, you know, it's r/Elon Musk at this point. Like, it's the things that he wants to see that centers, like, his own point of view. So that need to invent things from first principle is interesting in some business context and super dangerous and weird in politics, international affairs, health. Like, the idea that you're just gonna, like, you know, look at some tweets, read the Wikipedia page for, you know, the Russian Empire, and then suddenly
David Sachs is a general.
Let me tell you something.
I read a whole bunch of tweets about Ukraine, and these fucking experts, they're not really. It is this bias against expertise people's expertise. And it's like, I am very successful and I was really smart and I innovated and I built this company.
Right.
And because I built this company that was so successful, therefore, I can solve any other problem. I can go to other industries, I can go to other areas, and I can be an expert on everything.
And I think that's why RFK Jr. is actually a compelling candidate to these people. Now, I think there's a political nihilism reason as well, which is that they're super down to just, like, do something that that messes up the election and that nothing really matters. So let's just do let's endorse a candidate we never vote for just because it's...
Because also it's never going to really affect them personally.
Yeah, exactly. But there is an aspect, and you see this from others, of the vaccine is a hoax and, vaccines generally, and the CIA did kill, JFK, and, RFK is going to be the one to expose this. Probably they're hiding aliens. You just can see this activating all of those flavor centers for someone who believes that actually the world is bullshit and I'm smart enough to figure out what's real if I just look at the problem with the appropriate lens. And also, if you look at the text that Elon got, everyone in my phone is telling me that I am the solution to everything, right? I mean, everyone in the world, world's most famous, richest, smartest people are like constantly being like, we need you to work on this problem. Like, no one else is going to get us to Mars, to AI, to, a fossil fuelless future. You're the only solution for this.
Yeah. And everyone who works for me thought that my kitchen sink tweet was really funny.
Was amazing.
They all laughed in the meeting.
This is a piece of advice I have for anyone who's listening. It's a niche piece of advice, but you never know. If you're in the text thread with like a billionaire, if you happen to be in the group thread, you have a disproportionate obligation to speak up when a dumb idea comes your way and just be like, nah, chief, not this one. Let's pass on this one. Like, this is your, I'm telling you that you can make a big difference in the world just by like hitting the thumbs down react on some of these ideas.
We will leave it at that piece of fantastic advice. If you happen to be in a text thread with a VC guy, a billionaire, someone like that, just, you know what you have to do. Jason Goldman, thank you so much for joining Offline.
Thank you.
All right, we're back here with my friend Max.
Another fascinating week in tech.
I know.
There's so much going on.
We're being blessed by the news gods, not the tech gods.
The AI news god that determines all the news for us.
So Jason and I talked a bit about new laws and regulations to deal with AI, but we didn't cover the various attempts to hold the AI industry accountable with laws that are currently on the books. We found out this week that comedian and author Sarah Silverman joined a class action lawsuit against OpenAI, which runs ChatGPT, and Meta, which has a large language model of its own, for copyright infringement. And basically, the suit says that these companies have, quote, copied and ingested the protected work of Silverman and other authors in order to train their chatbots. Rolling Stone wrote the other week also about two other class action lawsuits filed recently that, quote, call into question whether AI violates privacy rights, scrapes intellectual property without consent, and negatively affects the public at large. What's your take on dealing with potential AI abuses, dangers through a legal strategy?
It's interesting because there have been so many rounds in the past of like people developing bots that scrape text or that, scrape images. And it seems like the fact that these lawsuits are coming so quickly really reflects an understanding that these aren't just university lab experiments anymore, that they are both derivative works of enormous commercial value on their own and also potential competitors. I do think it's striking that the Silverman lawsuit that she's joining has a pretty narrow claim, which is they say that the text database that the large language models are scraping includes another database that was partially pirated. So it's this kind of like specific, like, right, we're not objecting to the act of scraping, but rather we are kind of using this copyright infringement claim based on pirated text to like get our foot in the door to try to get the courts to litigate this before it advances so far that we can't roll it back, which I think is a lesson that people learned from a lawsuit that the publishers had against Google in 2005. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Over Google was mass scanning like every book in existence to put on their libraries, and publishers tried suing. The lawsuit took 10 years and then was also dismissed by a judge at the end of it because they claimed, or the judge said that they didn't have standing because it was
fair use.
Fair use, exactly.
That's what some people are worried about with this one.
Right. And I think there's a fear that if it takes too long, then the like AIs will create facts on the ground. It'll be too late to roll this back.
The AI will become sentience.
Based off reading Sarah Silverman's book about being herself. That'll be the thing that pushes it into the superintelligence.
From what I've read about this, the legal bar is high on copyright infringement, that you have to prove that like it's the full book. you know, and it's not because fair use otherwise is the argument that usually wins this for the people who are taking the
And the U.S. has pretty strong fair use protections because we have such a large entertainment industry. But I think it feels like this is a good way to slow things down. But if there is a concern that the existing laws do not offer sufficient protections, given the size, the potential size of the like AI-based, scraping-based industry, it seems like it would have to be legislative, ultimately. Like, there would have to be changes to laws, I feel like.
I also thought it was interesting that one of the changes that sort of led to these lawsuits is the fact that OpenAI started off as a nonprofit and then became a for-profit entity.
It's pretty telling.
And yeah, right. And so now that all of these AI companies are companies trying to make money, then it does open them to a lot of legal challenges for copyright infringement. You know, that's one argument. There's also the privacy argument.
Yeah.
And then a broader argument that one group made in their lawsuit that AI could cause civilizational collapse. which one do you think is most persuasive?
Is that what legal statute forbids civilizational collapse?
That lawsuit,
it feels like kind of an Air Bud thing. Like, there's nothing in the rule book that says you can't collapse civilization.
It starts with like a Stephen Hawking quote about AI, how it could like destroy humanity. Yeah,
it's so funny reading these legal filings. Is it like, as a professional writer, seeing the lawyers get so excited about like getting their quotes together, kind of like getting some good images and metaphors, and it's like, okay,
couple associates are pretty excited about what they've written. What do you think? I think the privacy argument is interesting.
I mean, I agree, and it makes sense as a way to try to have another angle at like who owns these works, and I feel like it's a good way to attack the entire idea of scraping as something that is like in itself a violation. Something I always found really telling is companies like Google that are now doing a lot of this scraping themselves have very strict rules against scraping their platforms. Like if you read the YouTube terms of service, and I assume Facebook has the same thing, and this is something I ran into when I was doing reporting on these platforms, they have very strict rules against scraping their platforms because they know that data at this size, even if the individual bits of data are free to access, data at that size has enormous commercial value.
Yeah, one of the arguments in one of these lawsuits on the privacy stuff is that they are scraping, like, you know, all of our data, or a lot of our data, too much of our data is on the internet. And if these large language models or other AI programs are scraping, like, the entire internet, then it's going to be able to compile a ton of data on each of us without our consent.
Which, I mean, the social media companies are already doing that. That's the basis of their business model, is compiling enormous amounts of data about us to figure out what is the ad that's going to get us to, or that they can sell against our eyeballs.
Yeah, and with them, you know, they're ostensibly doing it for selling advertising purposes.
Right.
But for the AI stuff, it's like, and also with that level of computing power, could the data be more predictive about who we are, what we do, behaviors?
Right.
Like, I think we don't know that yet.
Right.
But I thought it was interesting that one of in one of the lawsuits, it basically says, you know, Microsoft and Google have admitted they don't know where this technology is going. And then the full power of this, and yet they are scraping away. It's for-profit companies. I mean, like, what are we doing here?
They've always had an attitude of like scrape first and litigate later, which works well for them because the courts move slowly enough that they can get all the data, develop the technology. And then I was reading about the like 2005 publishers lawsuit against Google, and they offered a settlement equivalent to, I think, $200 million, which is just like, that sounds like a big number, but when you're capturing the entire publishing industry, that's like basically flipping the bird.
Yeah. So there's the publishing industry that has to contend with this. And also, as we saw from Sarah Silverman, there's the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
We're looking to do an episode on this next week or soon. But the use of AI does seem like it went from a fringe issue to something that's now at the center of the writer's strike, and now the actor's strike. You have any thoughts on that as you've been watching it all unfold this week?
So as you know from when we have talked before, initially my attitude was like, everyone's overstating the reach of this, what it's actually going to do in the very near term, and we're like getting ourselves bent out of shape. And then I saw this news story about the movie production companies offering this deal to SAG as part of their talks that was just like the most dystopian thing I'd ever seen, that they would pay actors.
Very Black Mirror.
Very Black Mirror, yeah. One day's salary, and then they would get to use their likeness in perpetuity. And this is for, my understanding is this is for background actors, so they're like, yes, when you see a big crowd, a lot of the faces in the background, and there is already like, they're already using CGI to, like, when you see 1,000 people, 10,000 people in the frame, that's actually 30 people and they've just copy paste them. So a lot of this is already happening, but seeing it in black and white, one day's salary, and then we own your likeness in perpetuity and can do whatever the hell we want with it. It's really dystopian.
Extremely dystopian. We gotta figure out what the real proposal is here.
Yeah.
Because
it's all,
I think you sent around this Reuters
and,
story about, yeah, it, and yesterday it was going around and you're like, what the this is, you know?
Right.
And now this, of course, this is the studios, right?
Right.
But the studios are saying that it's false, that the claim that they you can use them in perpetuity is false.
Right.
And it said the current proposal would restrict the use of the digital replica to the motion picture for which the background actor is employed. Any other use would require that actor's consent and bargaining for the use, subject to a minimum payment, the studios said.
Hmm.
But, like, let's see the actual proposal. Like,
sure.
I think this is going to be a challenge going forward.
Right.
In any event,
yeah,
the idea that... that these studios could just take your likeness,
yeah,
and just use it anywhere, or right, your voice. And then I'm sure with the writers, it's, again, it's scripts, it's premises, yeah, it's, yeah.
The speed with which this is displacing jobs like background actor is pretty striking.
Yeah.
One other, I thought, very striking show of the kind of anxiety around AI in Hollywood, Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning.
Okay.
What a picture.
So you saw it? Tell us.
I saw it. I don't know if you've seen any of the Christopher McQuarrie Mission Impossible movies.
I think I saw the last one. Maybe the one before that. I saw one of them recently.
Amazing action and the like dumbest possible plot exposition you could ever imagine.
That's what I remember, yeah.
But the reason I bring it up is that the plot, while very stupid, I thought was a really striking reflection of like where we are as a culture and society and how we feel about AI. So I won't spoil anything that doesn't come in the first like 20 or 30 minutes, but the like big villain in it is an AI that has become sentient that wants to destroy humanity or is an enemy of humanity for some reason, which we have heard before, right?
Yeah.
But what was new about this is instead of it being what typically happens where it's like the AI is going to launch all the nukes or it's going to like send our armies against the other armies, is there was this scene 20 minutes in where all of the like head of the Joint Chiefs in the CIA are like, the AI is going to seize control of how everybody around the world sees and processes information and gets the news, and will subtly manipulate it in a way that will make us all a little bit more radicalized and a little bit more extreme. And I was like, am I watching a fucking offline episode on the big screen here?
So the AI is just like a supercharged social media then?
They were literally, it was describing the Facebook algorithm. And there was this line that one of them had that was like, it can, without us even realizing it, will manipulate what we see and it'll turn friends into enemies and enemies into aggressors. And I was like, yeah, I've been on Twitter. I get it.
I have been thinking that on one end of the should we be freaked out by AI debate, there's like, ChatGPT isn't that exciting. Who cares?
Right.
And then the other end, there's like, the robots are coming to kill us all.
Right,
it's only a matter of seconds.
Right.
I do. That's the rating scale.
It does
scale
feel
run.
Like that's where we are, yeah.
But I do think that there are dangers, much like our friends at Mission Impossible laid out, that are somewhere in the middle that are still pretty significant,
yeah,
that we have not thought about yet, grappled with, imagined in many cases. And it could end up being quite bad for humanity in the way that social media has been quite bad.
Right.
And it also could have like benefits like social media originally had,
sure.
which then are overshadowed by sort of the darker stuff. And with the computing power for AI being so much more advanced and powerful than anything we've seen, that could happen more quickly and it could be a little bit more dangerous than we thought. Short of the like, you know, the AI nukes the world or there's a bioweapon or something like that.
Right. And it did, I mean, it, like, I remember like around the time you started the show, around the time I started reporting on social media, the idea that algorithms and AI could influence what we all think without us realizing it and steer our politics in dangerous directions was like kind of controversial, and people would roll their eyes at it. So I thought it was amazing that this like low to middle brow, big budget studio movie just assumes that like the audience will not blink at the idea that like, boy, Facebook sure is bad.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's pretty ingrained in the culture at this point.
I was thinking a lot about the portrayal of AI in movies and how it's changed over the years. And I like went back and was looking through all of the movies that had AIs in it. And it was really striking because there was this long period from like the 60s through the 80s and 90s where it's like the AI is going to raise up and destroy us. And they're like going to be the enemy of humanity.
Terminator.
Right. Yeah. Terminator 2001 is the first one, which is based on a short story from like 1951. So like a really old idea that like HAL 9000 is going to kill us.
Yeah.
But then there's this weird interregnum in the 2000s and 2010s where like the robots become really chill and become our friends.
Like Her?
Like Her.
Yeah.
Like,
I got to go back and watch Her.
Iron Man, Interstellar. Yeah. I don't know if you ever watched Star Trek The Next Generation, but there's like Data is just like a chill robot who is like learning how to be a person.
Yeah.
And it was this funny glimpse back into like Obama era optimism about tech that is like maybe the robots will be cool and maybe like in Her we'll get to fuck the robots.
And now,
right,
still might get to fuck the robots. Yeah. Then they might kill us.
But then they now will also destroy
it all together.
Yeah.
That's unsettling. Well, before we go, there's another very scary thing out there.
Oh my God.
TikTok. Maybe scarier than AI. And it is TikTok Live. This is a feature on the app where you can do live streams and get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
A few really weird ones went viral this week.
Yeah.
One particular TikTok Live that chilled me to my core. Can we play it?
Thank you, Kay. It was you. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you, 408. Thank you, 408. Thank you, King. Thank you, Olivia. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you, Yadi. Thank you, Abby. Oh, what is that? Gang, 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 gang. Yes, popcorn. Yes, popcorn. Yes, popcorn. Yes, popcorn. Oh, what is that? Thank you, Sophie. Thank you, emoji. Thank you, emoji. Balloon.
So this is, her name is, this is Pinky Doll?
Sure.
I don't even know what to say about this.
So as a recovering TikTok addict, thank you to the offline challenge for breaking me away from this. I would see a lot of these. You're scrolling through TikTok, you're looking at your like 20-second like little skits, whatever videos, and then these will pop up where it's someone broadcasting live.
Oh, it just pops up into your
feed? They just push it into your feed, yeah, because they want you to, you know, TikTok, they're so nice.
Yeah, I guess.
And it is always the most insane, weird thing that you've ever seen. But something that is really striking about it is it's always someone who looks like they're about to do something that will be like really satisfying to watch. Like in this video, she's about to pop popcorn in a curling iron and you're like kind of curious, like what's that gonna look like? Ryan Broderick, who wrote about this, said that it's like an equivalent of like someone about to finish a house of cards, about to put like the last card up. I've seen like Rube Goldberg machines. They look like they're about to set off, but they just never do. And they will go for like 10, 20 minutes. And the idea is that you're scrolling through it and it's like, oh, I just want to see them do this thing. So I'll watch for a second. And then they keep doing every like half a second, they will do something crazy. Just like make a weird noise or like do something weird with their face just to keep you watching. And the whole time they are soliciting donations from the people who are watching the live stream. And people will do it. People will give them like five, 10, 20 bucks. And I think they make a lot of money this way.
Why is anyone paying the money to watch the fucking popcorn pop? So there's a lot of comments floating around the internet, like tweets about this, because it's one of those TikTok videos that like hopped to Twitter where everyone's
commenting. And then everybody was like shocked to see this like weird underbelly of the internet.
A couple of the funny tweets were TikTok lives are proof that society is crumbling right in front of our eyes. What part of the human brain is this meant to light up? I don't know. I mean, I think this is the CCP right here. This is the Chinese government. This is their op against us. We just have like a whole generation of kids who are just gonna be fucking zombies watching this woman pop popcorn and say weird shit and
it is,
just giving
it
her
is,
money.
It's weird to see it. It's just like jangling keys, but like amped up by 1,000. But it actually did not start on TikTok. This is something that actually started with like Twitch streamers.
Oh.
And it would be like a lot of YouTubers or like video game live streamers would start these channels and they would just do anything they could to hold people's attention. And it's this like weird participatory thing. And a lot of the especially the like life live streamers, the parasocial people who are walking around like recording themselves all the time. It's like, give me $5 and I'll react. Give me $5 and I will do something. And you will get to feel like you're participating in this broadcast. And this is what the TikTok live streamers do too, is they will react every time they get a donation or it pops up on the screen. And it's something that comes out of the two pillars of the internet, which is video game live streaming and porn. Just, it's where it all starts. The foundations of our new digital civilization.
Well, it's this, I mean, this need for connection and to be seen.
Right.
And to, right? Like, right. Oh, I gave a donation. And that, because she's like thanking people. She's thanking different
she's
users.
She's reacting.
And it's a little
Everybody's
bit of the...
Everybody's watching is reacting.
Yeah, it's also a little bit of the Chris Hayes interview I did a long time ago on this. And he's writing a book about this. Like, everyone's famous now on the internet. And this like desire for fame.
Right.
And that's not fame on, like on a large scale. But if there's someone with all of these followers and suddenly they're acknowledging you, that's like cool for people.
Well, and if
I
know hundreds of people or thousands of people are watching, that's, I mean, this is something we've talked about a lot, is our brains are evolved for communities of no more than 150 people.
Yeah.
So if 1,000 people react to something you do, that's a really powerful jolt to your brain. I don't know that there's anything like inherently harmful about the TikTok live streamers, but it is very weird to see what the internet is becoming laid bare like this and have it be so like
it's nonsense,
creepy
zombie
and disturbing.
Shit.
Yeah.
It's just funny like reading the way different outlets have described this little phenomenon. Like I was reading this piece in the Daily Dot and they were like, this clip shows a woman robotically licking the air and repeating phrases like yes, 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 and ice cream so good.
But we're talking about it, right? Because it is just like anything you could do to hold people's attention for 0.3 seconds. What do you think we should do for our...
Touch fucking grass, people. Get out, put the phone down.
Oh, I'm ready to launch our TikTok live stream.
Okay. What do you want me to do?
I'm just going to start acting out.
Give me $5. I'll tell you Twitter is bad. Put your phone down for $10.
Get some legal strike takes. Yeah.
Oh, terrible. Anyway... Between AI and that, we're fucked.
Well, you've got some fun stuff to watch this weekend, Mission Impossible and TikTok live streams.
Yeah, I'm going
to... I'm excited for your journey.
Coming on Monday, and I'm just going to be like...
broken-ass brain.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Thank you to Jason Goldman for joining us today. Thanks, Max. And everyone, have a good week.
See you next week.
Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau. It's produced by Austin Fisher. Emma Illick-Frank is our associate producer. Andrew Chadwick is our sound editor. Kyle Seglin, Charlotte Landis, and Vasilis Fotopoulos sound engineered the show. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Michael Martinez, Ari Schwartz, Amelia Montooth, and Sandy Gerard for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Rachel Gajewski, who film and share our episodes as videos every week.